From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the fourth and final segment in a series of discussions about notions of the tragic in Western literature. Tragedy resists specific definition from antiquity through medieval, Renaissance, and modern interpretations. But there are several elements central to each of these: free will and choice, destiny, honor, suffering, and human pride. Speaking with reference to tragedies by Sophocles and Racine, the panelists in the following portion of the conversation are Eugene Falk, Robert Terhorst, Peter Burian, and Peter Smith. Eugene Falk and Robert Terhorst recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Peter Smith teaches classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Peter Burian is a professor of classics at Duke University. Here is Eugene Falk.
Now, if we accept the notion that in a tragedy, suffering is central, and I'm not sure whether we could do otherwise, then the question is, how does the heroic character deal with that suffering? What sense is attributed to the suffering? In Racine's play, Phaedra is struggling against her disposition, against her desires, and she is perfectly willing to commit suicide in order to avoid losing her honor and causing her husband the pain she would if she pursued her love. Now, if the struggle for a value in the midst of suffering is one criterion for a tragic action, then we have it there. And it is on that that Racine's play focuses. When we do suffer, what value guides our decisions? What value do we seek to impose on our lives and to suffer the consequences of having imposed it on our lives? And that is, after all, a theme that I think we could follow in many of the plays, of the tragic plays of antiquity. That is, after all, also true of Oedipus. He is willing to face the consequences of his suffering. His suffering is foreshadowed. And in the Antigone, there is no question. She too has to face the suffering by virtue of the fact of having taken it upon herself to pursue the line of action imposed by the chosen value. This is what a tragedy traditionally shows, and it also shows the inevitability of that struggle, if and when the hero has made a commitment. This is what I called earlier also the inclination to face, to accept the situation and to deal with it. There is in the Antigone a very important other character, namely Ismene, who chooses not to make the commitment to the value. She sees the value, but she doesn't make the commitment. Antigone does. This is why I said earlier, it is inconceivable for a traditional tragedy to act itself out unless the hero makes that kind of a commitment.
Here's one of these turns about love, normally considered a benign influence here shows itself through a whole range of malign manifestations. It goes back, of course, to the Minotaur and the Labyrinth. We have a prehistory, a very, very unfortunate prehistory to the play. So that one thing that Phèdre does is to show us a range of destructive loves. Theseus himself is very much inclined in this direction. But here is a play. I would say it's we do not find in tragedy absolute notions of good or evil, but rather that we find surprising discoveries about our normal perceptions of what is good and evil.
You were asking before, in a general way, about the tragic hero, and it occurred to me in thinking about that it's very difficult, it would be for me anyway, very difficult to set out any kinds of criteria by which one would declare a character to be or not to be a tragic hero. But there is perhaps some sense in which the tragic hero, by virtue of his situation, is a character in Nietzsche's phrase, beyond good and evil, where these categories simply don't apply at the sort of extremity of human experience in any neat or simply satisfying way. Oedipus might be adduced as an example, I suppose. There are perhaps more extreme examples. I think, for example, of another play of Sophocles, The Ajax, which involves the suicide of Ajax, whereas the Oedipus involves Oedipus' decision finally not to kill himself, but to go on living. Both of these might be said to be appropriate tragic choices for their heroes. Ajax, in his play, has polluted himself by an attempted attack on his erstwhile allies and friends, whom he now hates, his Greek allies, because they have awarded the arms of Achilles to Odysseus and not to him. Athena maddens him. He directs his attack on the cattle, and we begin the play with a horrible sense of his shame at what he has done. And yet not for one moment does he feel guilty of anything except failure, repentant of his wrath, humbled. And he, in effect, reconstitutes himself as a hero by disassociating himself from the world, by coming to and carrying out the decision to kill himself. There's no way that we can morally approve his actions, but we are not invited to disapprove them. The case of Oedipus is interesting because we certainly don't want him. The play would fall apart if at that point where Tiresias says, "Don't ask," and Jocasta says, "Oedipus, please, you don't want to know this." And finally, the very last time, the shepherd who holds the key to it all says, "Don't make me say it." If Oedipus said, "You're probably right. Let's talk about something else." We sense that his heroism is in some way located in this persistence about himself, wherever it leads.
Well, there's a kind of one dimension, at least of Oedipus, and I suspect of other tragic figures, is recklessness, to pick up with the term we were using before. A perseverance, despite it all.
We've been talking about tragedy and conceptions of the tragic. How much aware of these things are people in the world today? Are they being expressed today, and how? Peter?
I think that as Peter Burian made the point earlier in our discussion, much earlier in our discussion, that he finds his students come to classes already knowing or thinking they know what a tragedy is about. And I've had exactly the same experience, that students, when they come to college, to the university, have been told by someone that a tragedy is a play in which a hero with some flaw of personality or moral being, because of that flaw, brings himself down or is brought down. And it takes a good deal of persuasion to get one's students to think again, not necessarily to dictate to them a new or different notion of what a tragedy might be, but simply to look at the plays and see whether that's true, because it very often, most often, in fact, is far from true. And I suspect that what we're dealing with then is a widespread, culturally widespread attempt to control, to domesticate the great tragic plays of the past by thinking that we understand them and that what they illustrate is a kind of justice, a kind of neat justice by which those who are guilty of something are punished for it. And that's a trivialization of tragedy. But I think that outside of the classroom, the very same students who have been burdened with a false key to literary tragedy do very well understand that many things that happen to themselves and to other people are, in a real sense, tragic when events disclose that we do not control our lives in the way that, or that we did not control them. We're not in the kind of control that we thought we were most of the time. And when, especially when something that causes suffering or death to people occurs, which can be seen to have been logically preventable, but not humanly, not psychologically preventable, but to have been something into which people drove themselves. When we find that sort of occurrence tragic, I think we are really in touch with, in a basic way, the same sense of human shortcomings, tragic human shortcomings of ignorance that Sophocles and Aeschylus were trying to illustrate.
Perhaps in the world today, we have no full sense of tragedy and can have none. A world in which, when we discover our ignorance, when we discover our shortcomings, we have no way of relating them to something out there that we might know. When we see that we don't control our lives, we have no way really of perceiving what such a control would mean or how it would be achieved. I'm talking about, for example, what happens in a world in which at first science and technology seem to offer answers, and now with the possibility of atomic destruction looming over us every moment of our lives, with the pure products of technology gone crazy in certain ways, in the Love Canal and thousands of other sites across our country, for example. The sense of horror, which we've referred to more than once, is not lacking. The sense of an order that would in some way transform that horror into an experience of the tragic, I'm not so sure about.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the final segment in a series of conversations about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The panelists were Eugene Falk and Peter Smith of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona, and Peter Burian of Duke University. Professors Falk and Terhorst recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. The discussion of tragedy for Soundings continues now with a conversation about the tragedy of King Lear by William Shakespeare. The panelists are Margretta de Grazia and Kenneth Muir. Margretta de Grazia teaches English at the University of Pennsylvania. She recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a book about Shakespeare's sonnets. Kenneth Muir is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Liverpool. He's the editor of five of Shakespeare's plays, including King Lear, and is the author, editor, or translator of 50 books.
In the 20s and 30s, when I first came in contact with Shakespeare on the stage, one could be certain of seeing a play more or less as Shakespeare wrote it. Simple staging, no directorial tricks. They didn't try and impose their opinion of the play on the audience. But since 1945, you get quite brilliant directors who are determined to make Shakespeare relevant to the modern age. And I personally think that Shakespeare is relevant to the modern age without altering him at all. So that, for example, to make out that Shakespeare is our contemporary, as Jan Cott argued in his book, so that King Lear becomes, he actually entitles his chapter on King Lear Endgame, a sort of Beckett play, fin de partie, seems to me quite ludicrous because it destroys the real meaning of the play. And in order to do that, when Peter Brook did his movie, he cut out the conversation between the Cornwall servants after the blinding of Gloucester, because this was an intrusion of humanity into the play, which he didn't approve of, so that it couldn't be the theatre of cruelty if he had that scene in.
Professor Muir, is Shakespeare exhausted? So much thought, effort, time, scholarship?
I don't think it is, because each new generation comes with different ideas, quite properly. We see things in Shakespeare in the present generation that no previous generation could have seen. Troilus and Cressida, for example, was unactable. And even in 1920, when it was put on at the Old Vic, the Times reviewer said, it's nice to have seen it once, but we shan't have to see it again, thank God. And now it's one of the most popular of Shakespeare's plays. For the first time, we have realized what Shakespeare was trying to do in it.
I'm fascinated by the connection between the edition that someone like yourself prepares and the play as it is performed. For what reason do you believe that it's possible to observe a play without the scholarly trappings, whereas it's not possible to read it without them?
Well, I think, on the whole, directors underestimate the intelligence of audiences, partly because, as I mentioned yesterday, the average educational level of most audiences of Shakespeare is a good deal higher than many of the actors. And then, in addition to that, it's quite possible to understand the general drift of a speech, even though you don't know every word, because Shakespeare always appeals on more than one level. A famous example is when Macbeth says, multitudinous seas incarnadine, making the green one red. The second line explains the first line, so that even if you didn't know what multitudinous and incarnadine meant, and they were probably coinages at the time, Shakespeare has pity on the illiterates, if any, and explains it in the next line. So that I assume that if you don't play down to audiences, they will get much more out of it than you suppose.
And it is interesting that in so many of the examples that you listed, whatever is being appreciated of Shakespeare is being appreciated independently of the language of the poetry in English that he wrote, and that would also account for your very favorable and admiring response to a Russian production and a Yugoslavian production, that Shakespeare is present, even though his poetic and English formulations are not there, or are translated into a language that has little similarity to English.
Yeah. But if you add the poetry to the other qualities which are appreciated abroad, then any English-speaking country must, I think, put Shakespeare as the sort of crown of a liberal education. But to return to your question about the difficulties of a modern audience, I think Shakespeare always appeals on at least two levels, and that the groundlings, or their modern equivalent, will always have the plot line made perfectly clear, they will always have the characterization perfectly clear, and if they have ears at all, they will listen to the music of the lines, and they don't need to know the meaning of every word.
Well, I think that as you were speaking, I was thinking of a scene in King Lear in which It must not have been Shakespeare's intention that the language be understood, and that is in the storm scene where, with the background of the storm, you have Lear and his mad ravings, and that is in turn punctuated by the fool's riddles and enigmas that can, even if one has a great deal of time, are very difficult, if not impossible, to decipher. And in addition to that, you have Edgar's babble, and all of this is occurring to a background of the physical noise of the storm. And I think there are instances similar to that in other plays where the point is not to understand the meaning, the syntax that's conveyed by the straightforward syntax of the sentence, but rather to be struck by something like an effect that is carried in sound.
Indeed, it's the world upside down. Mm-hmm. The elements themselves are mad, and there are three people mad on the stage in different ways. Mm-hmm. And even though we don't believe any longer in demonology, mm-hmm. The kind of speeches which poor Tom has are sufficiently intelligible to any mm-hmm. audience. When Lear says, "Off, off, you lendings," referring to his clothes, because he's imitating poor Tom, it made perfectly clear to every member of the audience that unaccommodated man is a poor, bare, forked animal. They will all get that.
Mm-hmm. Professor Muir, you've commented, turning to Lear specifically now, that King Lear couldn't have been written in an age of reason or an age of faith. I don't know what kind of age we live in, but why? What did you mean by that? Why did you say that?
I meant that it was essential to have a questioning age, and yet an age which was fundamentally Christian, but with the doctrines of Christianity being called in question by some. You can, if you read Donne's sermons, or Donne's poems for that matter, you can see that people were felt themselves to be in an age of doubt. And yet underlying was the long 16 centuries of Christianity at their back. And if you come to the 18th century, you couldn't really have Shakespeare. And you can see that from Dr. Johnson's feeling that it was so intolerable that Cordelia should die, that he preferred the happy ending imposed on the play by Nahum Tate. They wanted everything to be tidy, and they wanted poetic justice. Poetic justice, it seems to me, to be one of the most overworked and meaningless phrases that one could possibly apply to drama.
I'd like to comment on that too, because I think that made a great deal of sense to say that the tragedy that is King Lear would be impossible in an age that was an age of faith or an age of reason. In an age of faith, everything is accepted as being providential. In an age of reason, everything makes sense as being in some way just. And what one is forced to witness and to some degree accept in King Lear are violations of what we would like to see as a providential order, what we would like to see as a reasonable order. And that, I think, possibility must exist for a tragedy to have its impact, that things might be taking place in the world that make no sense, that have no justifiable cause.
Or at least that we cannot understand.
Yes. Or if that cause is present, it's inaccessible to us in this world.
Now, Lear seems to speak to us because we are in a similar stage of doubt, I suppose. The orthodoxies are breaking down, and those who still call themselves Christians have inevitable reservations of, I doubt whether any people who believe in particular interventions of providence anymore.
To conclude the series on Soundings, about notions of tragedy in Western literature, I asked Kenneth Muir to read two favorite passages from King Lear. at the end of Act Two of the play, responding to his daughters Goneril and Regan, who have questioned his need for any of the trappings of kingly authority, Lear is on the brink of madness.
Oh, reason not the need. Our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is cheap as beasts. Thou art a lady. If only to go warm were gorgeous, why, nature needs not what thou gorgeous wearest, which scarcely keeps thee warm. But for true need, you heavens, give me that patience I need. You see me here, you gods, a poor old man, as full of grief as age, wretched in both. If it be you that stirs these daughters' hearts against their father, fool me not so much to bear it tamely. Touch me with noble anger, and let not women's weapons, water drops, stain my man's cheeks. No, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenges on you both that all the world shall. I will do such things, what they are, yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. I have full cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or ere I'll weep. O fool, I shall go mad. This is from Act 14.7, where the reunion of Lear and Cordelia, Lear waking from sleep. Where have I been? Where am I? Fair daylight. I am mightily abused. I should e'en die with pity to see another thus. I know not what to say. I will not swear these are my hands. Let's see. I feel this pinprick. Would I were assured of my condition. Pray do not mock me. I am a very foolish, fond old man. 40 and upward, not an hour more or less. And to deal plainly, I fear I am not in my perfect mind. Methinks I should know you, and know this man. Yet I am doubtful, for I am mainly ignorant what place this is, and all the skill I have remembers not these garments, nor I know not where I did lodge last night. Do not laugh at me, for as I am a man, I think this lady to be my child, Cordelia. Be your tears wet. Yes, Faith, I pray weep not. If you have poison for me, I will drink it. I know you do not love me, for your sisters have, as I do remember, done me wrong. You have some cause. They have not.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the fourth and final segment in a series of discussions about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The participants were Kenneth Muir of the University of Liverpool, Margareta de Grazia of the University of Pennsylvania, Eugene Falk and Peter Smith of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona, and Peter Burian of Duke University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for the concluding segment in a series of discussions about notions of the tragic in Western literature. From antiquity through medieval, Renaissance, and modern interpretations, notions of the tragic resist specific definitions. Yet there are central major themes, including free will and choice, ideas about destiny, honor, suffering, heroism, and human pride. The panelists include scholars from the Universities of North Carolina and Pennsylvania, Duke University, and the University of Liverpool. Notions of the Tragic in Western Literature, Part 4, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.